It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll get the latest on today's Legislative Budget Committee hearing on the $3 billion incentive package for the technology company Foxconn.
First, House Speaker Paul Ryan spoke at a nationally televised town hall event last night in Racine, tackling issues including Foxconn, Afghanistan, poverty, and the president's response to a white supremacist rally in Virginia.
The event was sponsored by CNN. The network gave invitations to some constituents and selected which questions could be asked by members of the public.
Outside the event, critics of Speaker Ryan held a protest rally.
WPR reporter Chuck Krumbach is based in Milwaukee. He joins us now for more on that event. Chuck, welcome back.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, Chuck, around the country, we've seen some raucous public forums for members of Congress. This was not that kind of scene, was it?
No, the raucous part is what Congressman Ryan, House Speaker Ryan, doesn't want. So he has been holding employee town hall meetings and telephone town hall meetings and much more controlled situations. Last night, he did agree to be interviewed by CNN and also take questions from, as you described, invited testimony, invited questions, and so on. So it was a much quieter thing. It didn't mean he didn't get some boos as he made some comments, but they were brief.
And did he get fairly tough questions from the audience?
Well, he did get a range of questions from both people that I think you would classify as Democrats and certainly some as Republicans. He got some people that didn't identify their political status. So there was quite a broad mix there. Of course, that he spoke right after President Trump described some potential plans for troops in Afghanistan. That was the first question, noting that there wasn't an end date in the president's remarks, and Congressman Ryan suggested that sometimes when we have an end date for actions in another country, that the opponents will wait us out. So that was the first question. Then he got other questions as well.
And one big question that's got a lot of attention, people asked Congressman Ryan about his reactions to President Trump's statements about the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. Ryan said the president had sent a mixed message, especially in his Q&A about a week ago. Here's a listen to a little bit of that.
So I do believe that he messed up in his comments on Tuesday when it sounded like a moral equivocation or at the very least moral ambiguity, when we need extreme moral clarity.
So that was just a piece of it. He kind of went back and forth looking at the different reactions from the president over the last week. Overall, what was Speaker Ryan saying about President Trump on this issue?
Well, that he made a mistake, but he's getting better, I guess, is the bottom line. That over this past weekend, President Trump made some positive comments about people opposing the white supremacy rallies. And that on last night during his address about the troops in Afghanistan, the president also made some points in favor of diversity and tolerance. But the more interesting, maybe the next question was then, is one of the, was from the public. In fact, it was from a sister of a former U.S. Senator, Russ Feingold, Dina Feingold, who's a rabbi in Kenosha. Said, okay, you have talked about the president messing up, but what about will you support a resolution to censure him, the president? And Ryan said no, that he didn't want this to turn into some political hack fest that would demean the country.
And this is a common position for Paul Ryan to be in, going back to the campaign where he wants to be supportive of his, you know, then nominee, President Trump, now president of his own party. But is trying to not necessarily be attached to some of the more controversial messages from the president. So really, the song remains the same for Paul Ryan in some ways.
In a way, sort of this just to the right of center, but not super critical of the president, but also trying to steer things back on to things Ryan says he really wants, things like a health care overhaul to pass both the House and Senate. It's passed the House. Ryan also talked about tax reform that he calls tax reform, tax overhaul that he wants to take place this fall. So he'd like to talk, I think, about these meat and potato issues in terms of money and health, but the president keeps getting in the way with some of these other very big social issues like white supremacy.
We're talking to WPR reporter Chuck Quirnbach about Paul Ryan, Speaker Paul Ryan's CNN event last night in Racine. We'll be talking with Chuck in a little bit about Foxconn, and I wanted to ask you about that, Chuck, as it relates to Speaker Ryan last night. He made the case that Foxconn was worth it for Wisconsin to pursue.
But the reason why I think this is exceptional and such a game changer is it brings a whole new sector to Wisconsin. This is, Scott Walker calls it Wisconsin Valley. I say we will be the industrial park for Silicon Valley. What I mean when I say that is it is really in our interest to get ahead of the curve on tomorrow's high-skilled, high-tech manufacturing jobs.
So it sounds like Speaker Ryan, Chuck, is on board with this incentive package to try to make sure Foxconn does open plants in Wisconsin.
Well, I believe so. I mean, he didn't say a lot new on Foxconn, did Speaker Ryan, than he has said before, but this was certainly a chance to highlight it on the national stage again, in addition to being at the White House a few weeks ago about it. But this was a chance to tell CNN that, listen, I'm trying to create help, trying to help create jobs, trying to help the state of Wisconsin create jobs. Of course, what he didn't talk about is whether wetlands protections that the Federal Army Corps of Engineers will have to review, whether that will be affected by the fact that the Speaker of the House is from the district where apparently the Foxconn will be located. Those are so. There's more to come about Ryan saying about federal role, but he does seem to support what the state is talking about.
And then, what happened at the protest outside of this venue?
Well, prior to the town hall meeting, about 150 people, 125, 150, gathered on the lawn of the Racine Theater Guild in a sort of a fenced or roped-off area, and held speeches, held a rally. Many were from the Racine Teachers Union, supporting, urging President Trump and Speaker Ryan to dial back on any proposed federal cuts to education and education programs. Others in the audience were supporters of Planned Parenthood. We heard from Gina Walkington, who has benefited from medical care set up by Planned Parenthood.
Healthcare is such a big issue for the members of Forward Kenosha. I would really like him to give a better answer for his fight to defund Planned Parenthood than he's given.
And is that a topic that came up inside the venue, Chuck, during the actual conference?
Well, of course, there was part of the healthcare overhaul that the House passed, but Ryan did not address that part of it. It remains very controversial in the Senate as well, the Planned Parenthood defunding, if you will. As Ryan suggests, there are other healthcare agencies that can provide care services for women, but those other agencies do not provide abortion services that Ryan opposes. So, again, he didn't touch that one, but certainly in the outer protest, it was on the minds of many of the proposed defunding of Planned Parenthood.
We've touched a little bit on Foxconn and President Trump, some other issues. Any other highlights that stood out to you at this event last night, Chuck?
Well, he's talking, he said he'd look into addition, the issue of opioid addiction and support for Narcan to be available. He again talked about the Trump Afghanistan plan and was largely in favor of it, the new Trump doctrine, Ryan said, talking about principled realism. He talked about a few more issues, but it's those main ones. And again, what seemed to make the most headlines was the saying the president messed up on white supremacy issue.
We're talking to a very busy WPR reporter, Chuck Quirnbach.
Coming up, Chuck stays with us to bring us up to date on today's legislative hearing on the Foxconn incentive package. Stay with us here on Central Time. The legislature's budget committee held a hearing today on the state's $3 billion incentive package for technology giant Foxconn. The plan passed the state assembly last week. As Sean Johnson reports, there are still a lot of unanswered questions about how it would work.
Backers of Wisconsin's Foxconn deal have compared it to the Louisiana Purchase, to the Green Bay Packers signing Hall of Famer Reggie White. And last week, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss introduced a new comparison when he read an email from a constituent.
In closing the email that he sent to me, he said, quote, "If you build it, they will come."
It was a reference to the 1989 movie Field of Dreams, when the character played by Kevin Costner is walking through his Iowa cornfield and hears a voice that no one else can hear.
If you build it, He will come.
Costner eventually listens and builds a baseball diamond in the middle of nowhere. Ghosts show up to play baseball, and by the end of the movie, people are coming from miles away to watch. In the state assembly, Voss said there was no way of knowing how transformational the Foxconn plant would be, but lawmakers would be proud of the day they voted to build it.
That'll be the day that you look back and say, I was part of something bigger than what I understood when I listened and debated that legislation. I was part of something that transformed our state in a way that I didn't even understand at the time.
The Foxconn deal, by its very nature, requires a leap of faith from the lawmakers who've been asked to approve it. Foxconn says it will build a $10 billion, 1.6 square mile complex in southeast Wisconsin, but the exact costs and benefits remain unknown.
So far, I have not seen the evidence that this is as transformative as you might hope.
Timothy Bartik is an economist who studies local economic development for the W.E. Upjohn Institute in Michigan. He says the amount of money Wisconsin is offering Foxconn per job created is about 7 times the size of a typical government incentive package. He says it could be 10 times larger once local incentives get factored in. The legislature's budget office projects the state would break even on its Foxconn deal in the 2042-2043 budget year if the company creates 13,000 jobs and 22,000 jobs spin off at other companies as a result. Bartik says that will never happen.
2042, that's a conservative estimate. It probably doesn't break even until 2142. If then.
Also skeptical is Einar Tangen, a Beijing-based economics expert who has studied Foxconn in China. Tangen says nobody has broken down the costs of this deal for local governments.
The state is writing legislation, but it's the big impact is going to be on the local economy, and those have yet to be defined.
Tangen says the package also gives considerable discretion to the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, or WEDIC, which has come under fire in repeated state audits. Under this bill, it will be up to WEDIC to decide whether Foxconn lives up to many of its promises.
No one knows what they're going to do. There's nothing in the statute that says it has to follow these rules or things. They basically said carte blanche. You decide.
And the bill exempts Foxconn from a variety of environmental permitting laws. Peter Adrians is a professor of finance at the University of Michigan who specializes in corporate water risk management. Adrians was surprised to see that the bill would waive some environmental permits for Foxconn even after it begins operating its liquid crystal display plant, especially given the company's reputation as a polluter.
To come to the state of Wisconsin, operate close to Lake Michigan, and take away all operational levers that you have in your policy toolbox to make sure this company operates responsibly. And that's effectively what the bill does.
Adrian says it's very trusting of the state of Wisconsin, given all the unknowns. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now we bring back Chuck Krumbach, WPR news reporter based in Milwaukee. He was at today's hearing in Sturtevant in about Wisconsin's $3 billion incentive package for Foxconn. So, Chuck, there we heard from Field of Dreams to risky business, basically. What was the attitude you heard from members of the Joint Finance Committee?
Well, I can't think of a movie metaphor, but it was very skeptical by the Democrats on the panel. The first 2.5 hours of the hearing was really more question and answer between Joint Finance Committee members and heads or almost heads of several state agencies. Much of the time was spent answering concerns about whether there are guarantees that Foxconn is making. Is the state at risk? Is there going to be environmental degradation? What about the number of jobs? What about the transportation of getting people to jobs? The list went on quite a bit, as I say, 2.5 hours worth. But one of the leaders of the state agencies, Scott Neitzel, the Department of Administration, tried to put a very positive face on things, of course, and said it's not just about 13,000 jobs, presumably, in the Racine-Kenosha area, but a ripple effect across the state.
Suppliers and suppliers to suppliers and suppliers to suppliers to suppliers throughout Wisconsin will benefit from the positive impact of this investment.
And this is a case that's been made, Chuck, by the governor and the assembly speaker and others, that this isn't just Foxconn jobs. This is something that's going to transform southeastern Wisconsin and beyond. Is that something you heard from others at this meeting?
That's right. And once the testimony got underway, and it's still continuing, folks like the chancellor of the UW-Milwaukee and the head of the Wisconsin Independent Colleges group are saying that this is a good thing. This is good for education as well as jobs in the area, that education will benefit and that money will go towards schools to help train these workers that are going to be needed.
Yeah, set the scene for us. Where was this event and how does it connect to the proposed Foxconn plant?
Sure. Well, this is at a building that Gateway Technical College operates. It's in Sturtevant, but it's not far from one of the two presumed sites for the Foxconn manufacturing plant, which is supposedly one of the sites is Mount Pleasant. Just we're talking about the west side of Racine, west of the city of Racine, out near the I-94 freeway. So that was why they were here. Gateway would like to be a part of this, a partner to the education here, and offered a building. It's very close to Sturtevant and very close to Mount Pleasant, I should say, and it's also very close, pretty close, I should say, to another possible site in Kenosha County in the town of Paris.
Talking to WPR's Chuck Kornbach about a legislative hearing today in Sturtevant about the proposed Foxconn plant and a state aid to help make that a reality. This was a public hearing, Chuck. Was there a lot of public there?
Well, there are quite a few people there. As I say, they had to wait a good amount of time because the quizzing went on of the state agency leaders. Once the public started to comment, as I say, there were some local officials, sort of Sean referred to in his piece about local concerns. By and large, Racine and Kenosha leaders sound in favor of Foxconn, but they do have some concerns, want some additional amendments to make sure the local communities are protected financially, and we'll have more reporting on that. So there was that testimony. Then there was some environmentalists raised concerns, including about the lack of an environmental impact statement by the state on this. Under the legislation, there would be, of course, permit reviews of various air and water and wetlands issues, at least the air and water issues. The federal government might have more to say about wetlands, but there wouldn't be an environmental impact statement, which is a much longer comprehensive study of all the issues. Environmentalists are asking for the EIS to stay in, to be put back in the legislation and give people a broader look at the comprehensive impact on the environment.
Democrats have raised issues and tried to make amendments in the assembly to the incentive package related to how many jobs would actually be created and whether those jobs go to people from Wisconsin or from south of the border, Illinois workers. Did those issues come up today?
Well, certainly there was a lot of that as well, in terms of a lot of skepticism from Democrats about, are we really going to have 13,000 jobs? Are we going to have a few thousand jobs? Are we going to have any jobs if Foxconn decides not to build? The state agency leaders and Republicans on the panel repeatedly expressed confidence that there would be a lot of jobs. But folks like a Democrat, Katrina Shanklin, the representative from the Stevens Point area, quizzed the head of WEDIC, Mark Hogan, about just, well, when would we get some of these guarantees? There's been a memorandum of understanding signed between the Walker administration and Foxconn, but there are still now negotiations on a specific contract. Shanklin, in her remarks, wondered about, well, we have to vote on something before there's a contract?
Is there anything in this bill that would, I mean, I heard you say multiple times that you're negotiating for clawbacks, but I mean, the language is permissive. It doesn't require the clawbacks to happen, correct?
That's correct. That's the statute as it's written today, aside from this legislation.
In this joint finance hearing, Chuck, was there a lot of talk about actually possibly changing this legislation before it's passed and sent to the governor, including issues like those clawbacks we just heard about?
Right, and of course we should mention the clawbacks are, well, what if Foxconn doesn't live up to its promises with the state tax credits that they're mainly talking about? be paid, or would you try to get money, claw money back from the manufacturer? And the state officials promised there would be a rigorous effort at that. There were joint finance, some joint finance members are talking about potential changes. Most of those are Democrats, however, and of course, Republicans control not only joint finance, but the state Senate, and as they have already controlled it, but they got their way in to this assembly version of the legislation that passed. So there's talk about changes, and if the local officials want changes on the like tax incremental financing, they might get some additional ones. Whether they'll be a big overhaul of this bill seems unlikely given the political clout of Republicans.
And Chuck, the Assembly, as we've talked about, passed their version of this bill. Now here's joint finance with a public hearing. What are the next steps in passing this incentive package for Foxconn development?
Well, we asked State Senator Alberta Darling, the co-chair, and Representative John Nygren, the other co-chair of joint finance, just before the hearing, they met with reporters. And this, of course, fits, a lot of this has to fit into the state budget talks. We're hearing some movement about the state budget today, but nothing concrete. So it's going to be, it sounded the way Senator Darling put it, that there's going to be a few weeks yet before a Senate and joint finance vote on things. So there'll be more debate, more newspaper stories looking at deals that have not materialized and haven't gone all that well for this, for various states. And so probably in September, they hope to have the contract ready for everybody to see in September, whether that'll be before the legislators vote on the legislation or after, I'm not quite clear.
We'll leave it there for now. Chuck, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Yep.
That's Chuck Krumbach, WPR News reporter based in Milwaukee. He joined us to share his reporting first on Speaker Paul Ryan's town hall in Racine last night, and then his coverage of today's hearing on the Foxconn incentive package.
Coming up after the news, a political observer says that to regain its stature, the left needs to move away from so-called identity politics. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. In the aftermath of the Democratic Party's crushing defeat in November 2016, pundits, analysts, and everyday people have debated what the Republicans did right, what went wrong for the Democrats, and what the left would have to do moving forward to have a better chance in 2018 and beyond.
Historian Mark Lilla's New York Times editorial just days after the election sparked a lot of debate and even outrage in some corners. His premise was that the left had ceded the idea of citizenship to the right in its efforts to appeal to small subsets of the American electorate. And that's the subject of his new book, The Once and Future Liberal, Beyond Identity Politics. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
So when you say identity politics, what exactly do you mean?
Well, there are two ways of understanding it. One is in the analysis of social problems. So if we're going to talk about law enforcement in this country, for example, we have to talk about race. And so you could say that's identity politics. When it comes to analyzing a problem, we have to talk about people's, whether racial or gender, identities for many problems. But there's another kind of identity politics, and that is not about analyzing a problem, but about addressing it. And beginning in, it really started in the 70s, but from the 80s on, liberal Democrats got transfixed by the notion that we're all just groups, that there's no universal democratic we, and ended up focusing on difference rather than commonality when it came to building a program to address the problems that you understand in terms of identity. So there became a disconnect between our analysis of social problems and our ability to do something about them by articulating a vision of what we are as a country together, what it means to be a citizen and what we owe each other. So as identity consciousness increased, our political consciousness and our political effectiveness declined.
So give us a concrete example or two of, in the run-up to the 2016 election, how the left was, in your thesis, kind of being held hostage by these identity politics.
Well, it's less being held hostage than it is a mentality. I'm trying to understand a way of looking at politics that I think has gotten us into trouble. So, for example, when Hillary Clinton was on the stump, what she would often do at the beginning or the end of her remarks is she would call out to various groups that were there. And so she would call out to women, to Latinos, to African Americans, to gays, to the disabled. And, you know, a certain kind of Democrat was very happy with that because it sounded like we're being diverse. Well, a lot of people were left out of that list. Nearly 40% of this country is Southern. One out of every four Americans is an evangelical. And in the parts of the country that we need to win back, you really find a lot of Southern evangelicals. Those people were implicitly excluded because in the Democratic idea of identity politics, there are certain groups that we focus on either because of their suffering, but also just for historical reasons. Those are the things we're interested in. And we've become detached from what people are experiencing elsewhere in the country. But even more importantly, we get out of the habit of speaking to all citizens together as a way of bringing them together to fight social problems.
So is it a question of numbers? Because didn't the GOP also use identity politics in 2016? Because they had a pretty clear and successful appeal to those white, rural, and suburban working class voters.
Well, there are two things to be said about that. One is, I think it's a convenient myth to say that that's why Donald Trump won. I think it shows an unwillingness to look in the mirror and look at what we were doing. Yes, there are the dog whistles, and we know about those. And there are more than dog whistles with Trump, certainly. I mean, the way he spoke about Mexican rapists, the way he spoke about, you know, Arab American soldiers and so on, Muslims in general, that was pretty in the open. Do I think that that was decisive in his election? I don't think so.
No, but I'm saying more that not any of the negative things against other groups, but the ways that the GOP spoke to those same groups that you said that the left was failing at.
Well, you're assuming that these people think of themselves as a group, right? That is the groupthink that is the problem, that if we're not talking about that, everyone's talking to groups. And so the Democrats talk to certain groups and the Republicans talk to other groups. But, you know, the important moments in American politics have been the big changes in American politics ever since the 20th century have come when a politician comes along and is able to offer a common vision that a lot of people find compelling and put aside a lot of their differences and identify instead with the message. So from the New Deal up until the 70s, there was a sort of Roosevelt dispensation, I call it in the book, that kind of took it for granted that after, you know, the Gilded Age and all the rest and the Depression, that we're all citizens in this together, that solidarity is important, that equal rights are important, and that it's legitimate to use government in order to pull us together. And that was kind of a vision of what politics is. And it was so powerful that even Republicans sort of had to work within it. So people forget, I think, that Richard Nixon proposed a rather radical plan for a guaranteed minimum income and also national health insurance because the terms of debate had been set by this dispensation. Then along comes Reagan, and he says, forget that picture. I have another picture of our country and our destiny and what holds us together. And that's that we're individuals. We belong to churches. We belong to our families. But government is the problem. There are very few legitimate purposes of government, that as long as the economy is growing, everyone's going to be fine. And if not, well, that's your problem. And so a new vision came along. And when that vision held, even Democratic presidents had to work within it. You know, Bill Clinton had to say, you know, we're going to end welfare as we know it, and government can't do everything, right? Well, those two pictures, visions of the country, have died. Donald Trump buried the Reagan Republican Party, and now we're at a point where we're a visionless society, and neither conservative Republicans nor liberal Democrats have managed to articulate a vision of where we can go as a country and what we are, such that people think less in terms of the groups they belong to and more in terms of this project, whether they like it or not.
Mark Lilla is a humanities professor at Columbia University's History Department. His most recent book is The Once and Future Liberal: After Identity Politics. And so you talked about FDR and you talked about Reagan's and how they were successful from very different positions in appealing to this broader America. So what's the message that the left needed to communicate in order to win back in 2016?
Well, I think we get too focused on presidential elections. I mean, they follow their own rhythm as well. The thing I'm really worked up about are state and local elections, because there are large parts of the country where we are not competitive, where, you know, two-thirds of the nation's governors are Republican, two-thirds of the state legislatures are Republican. And 25 states, half of the states now, are controlled entirely by the Republican Party. We only have six states like that. So we have lost the trust and the respect of a large chunk of the country. And what needs to happen is not just making an adjustment for the next presidential election. It means a real, as I said, look in the mirror. And both a look in the mirror, so we can get back in touch with our fundamental principles that we all share despite our differences. And the other is we've got to get out of our bubble. You know, we've got to go to places that we're not used to going to. You know, I tell students who will go off, you know, and spend a summer in Somalia or something like that doing very good work. But when I suggest that they go to Arkansas and work on a local election, they look at me with horror. And I tell them, look, you got to learn something about this. You got to go to places where the Wi-Fi sucks, where you have no desire to take a picture of your dinner, and where people have their heads bowed in prayer in thanks for that dinner. We have become an elite party, elites both not only in the party structure, but in the university, in the press, in the legal profession. And we all too often are just speaking to ourselves, and our conception of what's going on in the country is incredibly provincial.
We're talking with Mark Lilla about his new book, The Once and Future Liberal: After Identity Politics, and whether the left has to shift their focus to appealing to a broader range of voters in order to win elections.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with his analysis of the causes of the losses that the Democratic Party has suffered, not just last November, but in many recent years? Do you have concerns about what issues might not be addressed if the left, if the Democratic Party, turns away from these so-called identity politics? Are there issues you care about that fit under that heading? What message, if you have left the Democratic Party, what message do you want to hear to bring you back? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing the conversation with Mark Lilla about his new book, The Once and Future Liberal: After Identity Politics.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think, looking at the Democratic Party, that they, their leaders, their politicians have focused too much on groups, particular groups, identity politics? Do you think they need a wider, more all-embracing message to appeal to the whole country? What has gone wrong for the Democratic Party that they've lost ground, not just, as our guest says, in the presidential election last year, but in Congress and in the state governor's offices, state legislative offices as well? Do you think the Republican Party has done a better job at delivering an all-encompassing message, something that appeals to all citizens of the country? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Mark, many of the groups and issues that fall under that heading of identity politics have dealt with systematic oppression in American society. I'm thinking of LGBT people, women, and people of color specifically. If a party doesn't champion them specifically, isn't there room for concern that maybe their status will again be eroded?
Well, I can understand that, but the thing that we need to focus on and get through our heads is that you can't protect anyone if you don't hold political power. That an election is not a seminar. It's not a therapy session. It's not about speaking up and expressing yourself and where you come from. It's about winning political power. Now, what makes us liberals is that we care about these groups. And in a way that conservative Republicans don't even talk about them. That's why we're liberals. But what we have to focus on is not catering to them rhetorically, but rather winning so we can actually do something. Look, what's the greatest threat to a woman's right to abortion today? We have a constitutional right to abortion, thanks to the Supreme Court, but also thanks to the women's movement for many decades. But there are large parts of the country where a woman cannot get an abortion. Why is that? It's because these are states that are governed by conservative Republicans who have certain views about abortion, and they are using every means at their disposal to prevent a woman from having an abortion. If we can't struggle for power in that state, if we can't persuade voters in these southern and southwestern states that we stand for them, we have no way to protect a woman who wants to get an abortion. And so we have to get over the sort of symbolic jockeying over who's getting mentioned and bowed to and actually win power, because we know we want to help these people. The real fight comes in how to translate our message in such a way that people who belong to these groups and people who don't recognize themselves. And you got to reach out. For example, you know, a big issue the past couple of years has been police treatment of African Americans, and especially the flashpoint of African American motorists. I'm not an African American motorist. I never will be one. And so I can never fully understand. I mean, I can be as sympathetic as I can, but I can never fully understand what it's like to look in the rearview mirror, see those lights going, and feel, you know, a muscle cramp in your stomach. But if I want to get other people to take that seriously and sympathize, I need to somehow make, let's say, a white motorist somewhere else sympathize and identify with the experience of that motorist. And if we were to focus, for instance, on equal protection under the law, which is the principle at stake when it comes to these situations, then I think we can appeal to people and people will see that this is an outrage that this happens. But if, on the other hand, we do what Black Lives Matter does and take these incidents as an occasion to indict the country and its history, that's not going to win over anybody.
Let's go to our callers at 800-642-1234. And Louise in Kronenwetter is up first. Louise, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Okay. I wanted to just verify that I really agree with your guest today. And I think about the Democrats, so much of the time is spent on urban or large cities. And I feel like when you get to rural areas, that people are still fighting for better access to health care, for better access to high-speed internet. You know, their children are on a bus for over an hour a day to get to a consolidated school district because the town can't afford to keep schools open anymore. And I feel like a lot of those people feel abandoned. I, on the other hand, my husband and I both used to be staunch Republicans. but the Republican Party abandoned us. We feel that. And, you know, that conversion probably started about 8 years ago for us, maybe a little bit longer than that. I wanted to call to say I agree with your guest, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Great. Thanks for that call, Louise. Mark?
Yeah, well, I hear you, Louise. That's really all I can say. You know, African Americans make up about 17% of the American population. That's a sizable chunk of the population that we need to speak to. Well, rural residents of the United States also tally up to about 17%. But that's not part of our political rhetoric because that doesn't fall under an identity category. And you're talking about the school situation in these rural areas. You know, there are problems with schools in our country, whether it's in rural areas or whether it's in urban areas. And so were we to focus on the school problem and the right to a decent education and the need for a decent education for participating in the global economy today, that's something that I think Black urban parents and white rural parents would get. And that's exactly the kind of bridge building that we need to engage in.
Louise, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Owen in Wyoega. Hi, Owen.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking this. So you got to stand for something in this day and age. You have to have integrity. As an individual and to be a member of a church or a family, you don't want to have somebody in your church or your family that you can't trust. So if you take Paul Ryan, for instance, the whole time before Trump was nominated and actually got elected as president, he was talking never Trump, never Trump. And now he's his best friend. So who do you trust? You trust a guy that can't even stand up for what he believes in from one election to the next?
Thanks for that call, Owen, and I want to make sure that Mark has a chance to respond. So Owen's saying the important thing is being able to believe what people are saying during the campaign, that'll be what goes into place after.
Yeah, and what makes it difficult, I think, for our politicians now is that given that there are no governing ideologies or visions of the country where they can articulate, you know, principles that they hold on to and people recognize, what they're left to do is to kind of try to position themselves and break us up into various segments and to try to, you know, convince everyone that they're on their side. And what that leads to is a kind of, you know, kind of shadiness of position, not financial shadiness, but and when people keep contradicting in their actions what they say, then people lose trust in them. And, you know, it's perfectly understandable that Owen has the reaction that he does.
So, Mark, as we start wrapping up here, we asked earlier about what the message that the left needed to communicate to win in 2016 was. And again, not just at a presidential level, all levels. Looking forward, what do you think the messages need to be in 2018 and beyond?
Well, you know, as I said, the book is really about the very long term and kind of shifting our attention and the way we talk. And that's going to be the work of a generation, I think. But in the short term, you know, I think we really face an opportunity because both of these visions of American destiny that have died out and Donald Trump buried the party of Reagan, we have an opportunity to move in, and it just means starting, I think, by articulating the two principles that we've always stood for, solidarity and equal protection. And all the things we care about, whether it's on the one hand, you know, workers in Rust Belt towns.
And I'm sorry, Mark, but we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today. Mark Lila is a humanities professor at Columbia University in the history department. His most recent book is The Once and Future Liberal, After Identity Politics. And he spoke with us about that.
The eclipse has come and gone, and many of us have done the nearly impossible, gotten a hold of some eclipse glasses. But now that it's over, what do we do with those glasses?
You can't really use them as daily wear sunglasses. They're really too dark to see anything except for the sun.
And some creative types, maybe people more creative than me, could use them for an abstract art project or something.
But really, when you get right down to it, they are good for one thing, and that is looking at eclipses. The organization Astronomers Without Borders says it's going to kick off a program to collect glasses from the Great American Eclipse and then donate them to children in Asia and South America for solar eclipses that are coming up in 2019.
The group's president says, quote, many schools in developing countries don't have resources for science education. This is a rare opportunity that inspires students and teachers and shows them that science is something they can do. It can be a ray of hope for young people who don't otherwise see a path to a career like this.
Look up the Astronomers Without Borders website for more info. We do have a link on the Central Time Facebook page. And I just want to give Rob Ferret a shout out because he got hold of some glasses, and he was very good at sharing.
That's right. Yeah, we were all gathered down on our fourth floor landing there, looking up and passing around the glasses. Somebody had, we mentioned yesterday, the homemade box that you could look in.
That was awesome, too.
And hopefully nobody had, you know, pink eye.
Yeah, because otherwise it'll be the Great American Pink Eye Explosion slightly later 2016.
If there's a day when none of us are here on Central Time, that's the reason why. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.